Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 113 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, novelist and screenwriter Mick Jackson speaks with James McConaughey about the creative writing MA that launched his career, the creative role of the conscious and unconscious mind, and the threads uniting his diverse oeuvre.
I'm sitting with the novelist Mick Jackson in his studio in the centre of his hometown, Brighton. He's not a native. Born in the Lancashire mill town of Great Harwood, Mick was a drama student and a singer in indie bands before he signed up for the Creative Writing MA at the University of East Anglia. His first novel, The Underground Man, was shortlisted for the Booker and Whitbread First Novel Prizes. He has gone on to write two further idiosyncratic and moving literary novels, Five Boys and The Widow's Tale, and two brilliantly eccentric collections of stories, Ten Sorry Tales and Bears of England. Mick, it's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to see you, James.
The University of East Anglia. Did you know, before you even began, that you would spend the next 20 years being a writer?
I was 30, 31 when I did the course, so I felt like I'd dabbled in music, and I felt ready to do something that might take up, a good few decades.
It sounds as if your writing career was launched by that MA course at UEA. Is that true?
In a way it was, in that at the time there weren't that many creative writing courses about, and, you know, publishers paid attention to that course. So there was this rather terrible party at the end of the year where Mark and Bradbury invited publishers and agents up from London, from the trade, and you were introduced to them and took their cards. It was like some sort of 18th century kind of dance, you know, where you had your little card filled. But it was fantastic, and then I met an agent, Rose Tremain, bless her, dragged me and a friend off the wall and introduced us to a couple of agents, and, you know, that was the agent I was going to get published with. I was convinced for the next three or so years that it took me to write that novel. And the fact that it was a different agent that ended up representing me doesn't undermine the fact that it was very useful to have somebody who was in the trade that I was aiming for. So yeah, back then it was, I think Lancaster did a course, Norwich certainly, maybe one or two other places did creative writing courses, whereas now most colleges do them, and that's, you know, I think that's a better state of affairs. But back then, if you got into UEA, you just naturally thought, well, I'm the next issue guru, I'm the next Ian McEwan, and it's all going to be plain sailing from now on.
So it gave you an agent, and it gave you the sense that publication was well within your reach. What did it do for you creatively?
The great thing about a creative writing course, I think, is that you're ideally amongst other rookie writers on a regular basis, and you feel more like a writer. So you have that support. You have your support of your tutors and their expertise and their appreciation of your work, hopefully. And you have your contemporaries. And you get, it sounds revolting, but you get to take yourself seriously for a year, in my case, at Norwich, as a writer. I mean, you know, admittedly, you were sort of holed up on the outskirts of Norwich in the middle of East Anglia, which is a wonderful place to be, but on the, you know, essentially you were trying out being a writer, and I think there's no substitute for that. And I certainly focused more on my writing that year than any year up to it, certainly. So yeah, it was a great way of convincing yourself that you're a writer, and that, you know, to give yourself some self-confidence, I suppose.
You've described yourself elsewhere as having a working class background. Does that background explain why you perhaps, before that moment, had not convinced yourself that you really were a writer?
That's a good question, because I do feel sometimes that if I tried to be a writer in, say, the 1940s or the 1950s, you know, the Harris tweed jackets of the industry would have nudged me out the door. I could be wrong, but I suspect that. I suspect I wouldn't have been part of that club.
You've described the process of creating the character in the location as revealing what is already there. This is the words you used to me before this conversation. It made me think about the classic way of talking about classical sculpture, that you are revealing the form within the piece of stone. I think it's Michelangelo, I may have misremembered that. There's clearly something that you're working towards that almost feels like it is pre-existing.
Yeah, But I think those are the two parts of your mind operating again. The conscious part of your brain knows that you're just making this up, that this is just stuff that you're gluing together and trying to fool yourself and then somebody else into thinking that this really happened. Another part of you, a kind of rather more primitive, superstitious part of you, thinks, no, this really did happen. I've got to convince myself that this is of weight, of, you know, emotional, spiritual weight, and that what I'm actually doing is just moving around it. I'm endlessly circling it until I understand what it is that I'm doing, and I'll try this out. All right, well, that works. Her being that age, that works. Her being like this doesn't work, as that blah blah. So you're sort of, yeah, you are kind of chipping away at it. So it's, you can find 100 different ways to describe the creative process.
On the face of it, the three most conventional novels you've written, I'm excluding for the moment 10 Story Tales and Bears of England, those three couldn't be more different. And yet, as you read them, as you reread them, you do see preoccupations emerge. Are you aware of your preoccupations? Do you become irritated with yourself? Here I go again, you know, badgering away at the numinousness of the object, or whatever it might be. You know, the David Lodge novel, where the character is a novelist.
Right.
And he has his novels run through a computer program for the first time in the 70s.
Oh, right, okay.
And it reveals to him his most commonly used words, and he's confronted with who he is. And I forget the words, but they're brown, sludge, grime. And as a result, the writer is silenced.
Yeah, no, exactly.
But there is a question here. Is there a sense in which reflecting too consciously on the conscious parts of your craft inhibit the unconscious? If you know, oh, here I go again, Mick Jackson.
Whatever it is you do, certainly if you're in the creative industries, you're aware of what you do, what you're drawn towards, you're aware of what you think you're good at, and you're aware of what you're probably not so good at. And you're never going to do one of those things. I mean, I know what my little tropes are. The book that I'm working on next, which is the uncompromised, pure project of the future. You know, if you ask a writer what their favourite book is, you always want to say, what's your best book? The next one, you know, the one I've not actually sullied by writing yet. That, I feel, will be absolutely unlike all my other novels. And hand on heart, it feels absolutely different to all my other novels. And yet, if we're talking again in 3 years' time, 4 years' time, I'll be able to see that there's, you know, traits and shapes in the novel that have been in all my other books. Of course I will. So, no, it doesn't bother me. In a way, we're all just writing and rewriting the same book. But then, you know, some of my books are funnier than others. Some are a bit more serious than others. I've noticed that Faber now described 10 Story Tales and Bears of England as curiosities or something like that. Which in a way, I think, is slightly demeans them. But at the same time, I think, no, that's right, they're curiosities. I like the fact that they're slightly uncategorisable things. When I started writing Bears of England, that was going to be a novella. And I still think of it as a way of, as being a novella, because it's all these connected stories that have this chapter at the end that kind of pulls them all together. But it's a weird book. It's one, you know, it's probably my weirdest book, and I'm delighted I wrote it. So, you know,
you mentioned humour as well, and I would agree. I think your novels are very funny, not like Kingsley Amis or you know, an English comic novel, but there is a lot of buried, dark humour that's laced with pathos. I imagine you would resist this, but do you ever feel like you're writing comic novels? Because, of course, they're serious and literary and moving, and they made me cry at the same time.
Yeah, that's a good, really good question, James. Honestly, I was about to say, oh, well, we don't give comic novels or, you know, humour in novels the same credence that we do weight and gravity and all the rest of it. But then the next minute I was thinking, no, my novels aren't whimsical pieces like that, they're quite serious novels sometimes. So I'm as guilty of that idea as anybody else. So I like the fact that, or to put it another way, some of my favourite writers are poignant. You know, there's moments of great levity followed by great seriousness, and I think that's the way to do it. Personally,
it's something that is distinctively British, I would say. Do you feel Mick Jackson like a distinctively British novelist?
I think I'm a very British novelist, but I never set out to be. And so, you know, I've got young kids and I'm reading the Roald Dahl now, and I think, oh, this is why people used to say that I was like Roald Dahl. I never read any Roald Dahl until the last few years. I mean, what a fantastic writer. But also Saki, you know, the guy, the short story writer, And in a way, I think, well, that's you know, that's fine. He's a wonderful writer, so I'm delighted to be compared to him. But I imagine that there's some weird psychic well beneath Britain that produces all these weird writers, and I'd like to think I'm just one more being spat out of the volcano at the top of it. You know, there's some sort of weird sensibility that allows for that dark wit or edge to be used in there somewhere,
and the eccentricity, both in the form of a book like Bears of England.
Mm.
And in the characters, I mean, this is what unites your fifth Duke of Portland, who is, of course, not the real fifth Duke of Portland, and your widow, your unnamed widow. Both are funny about themselves and the situations they find themselves in, however catastrophic those situations actually are.
Yeah.
And that's a very English trait, or British trait.
No, I suppose it is.
We've talked about the creative process. What struck me is that they are evidently researched novels. One of them is almost historical, another one is set, The Widow's Tale, in Norfolk. Five Boys is semi-historical. Does the Second World War count as a historical novel? I don't know.
Yeah, these days, I thought.
Is the research a major part of the creative process for you?
The short answer is yes, it is. The second, slightly longer answer is that it's... I've been in the habit of saying that it's a way of doing something, making lists, gathering information while you're working out what the narrative is, or what the story is. So I had a pretty good idea with The Widow's Tale that it was about this character and these kind of things happened along the way. But researching it and talking to women who'd lost their husbands when they were that sort of age made me think, oh, well, that's something else I could gather in. So it's, you know, I kind of build my... It feels to me that I build my stories out of the bits and pieces that I find. You know, that I talk to real academics and I use the word research, and I realise that my research is nothing like what they do. You know, I talked to an academic last week about something and I thought, God, I might as well be talking to someone from a different planet. I use the word research and I could almost hear him snort with derision down the telephone at me. And that's fine. You know, I'm in the humanities, man, leave me alone. But it's research in that it's turning stuff over. So I was chatting to someone last night, they used this word churn to do with the internet. And I thought, no, that's a useful phrase, the idea of churning stuff. And that's
turning milk into butter.
Yeah, it's just that kind of worrying away at something, and then things emerge, or you think, oh, that's interesting, I'll take that bit out, I'll add that to my little collection.
So this is not a question I normally ask in this kind of interview, it's more for a police interview, but did you actively seek out recently bereaved widows, Mick?
Well, I'm afraid I did, and for my new novel, I actively sought out young Japanese women in their 20s, because my protagonist is a young Japanese woman who happens to be in the UK. So it would seem ridiculous not to do that if you're, you know, if you're writing a gothic novel, you read gothic novels, or you talk to academics who know their stuff, or you read books about Victoriana or whatever else. So I probably interviewed maybe five or six women, and these days more than any others, you know, it's pretty easy to get hold of someone who knows about basset hounds, or somebody who knows about construction of weather vanes, or whatever the hell it is. You know, a friend of a friend of a friend always knows someone who's had that illness or done that kind of research, and I like it, to be honest. I like meeting people who know more about things than I do, and it might, as often as not, it's, you know, some tiny detail that might have nothing to do with them being Japanese or recently widowed or Victorian or interested in Victorian stuff that appeals to me. But I think, no, the fact that that woman, when I was chatting to her, talked about this, or that she dressed like that, or had this habit, I think, no, that's useful to me. And in a rather superstitious way, I think that gives a certain potency to the stuff that I create. And I'm aware that I'm probably deluding myself when I'm doing that, but I think it's useful. You know, it convinces me as a writer, and what my job as a writer is to convince the reader. So if it helps me have the confidence to execute a scene with a certain confidence, then that's grand, that's the job done.
And in terms of locations, did you visit the estate of the fifth Duke of Portland? Are the tunnels that everyone talks about in The Underground Man, do they exist? Did you go to them?
They do. I mean, to be honest, the reason I started researching the fifth Duke of Portland was a particular friend of mine, a painter called Kevin Hendley, and I'd mentioned to him or his girlfriend that I was working on these stories about tunnels, and one of them said, oh, well, you should look into the fifth Duke of Portland. And I'd never heard of him. I mean, a lot of people knew about the fifth Duke of Portland, but not me. And Kevin grew up very close to the estate, what's left of it, Welbeck Abbey. And so when he was a kid, he used to sneak onto the estate and go down the tunnels with his mates. What a great childhood he had. So he said, oh, well, I'm going up to see my dad next week. They still live up there. Come and stay, and I'll show you around the estate. So there are some public footpaths over the estate, but he knew where to slip off them and how to get to access to where the tunnels came out. So it was like, you know, two guys in their mid-30s pretending that they were 2 8-year-olds sneaking around the grounds of the Welbeck Abbey. It was fantastic.
I'm very struck that you mention how easy it is to find people nowadays, to find experts who can tell you things you did not know. Also that you hadn't heard of the 5th Duke of Portland then, lots of other people do. Of course, what's changed is that as a writer, you can instantly, at the stroke of the enter key, find out all about the Duke of Portland.
Yeah.
That strikes me as both useful and possibly disabling.
Yeah, no, I agree. In some ways, I think I was doing something yesterday, and I was thinking, how fantastic. We've got this living encyclopedia at our fingertips. I mean, I'm not online down here, actually, in my office, just because I'd be too distracted. Right? That day may come, but when I'm down here, I like to be here and doing my writing. But yeah, when you need to check a fact, you know, you can pick out your phone and just Google away, and there you are. You remember that obscure Polish writer that you couldn't remember the name of 10 minutes ago.
Does that mean that the story has already been told, though? Does it kill any of the instinct to turn it, to transform it into something else?
My worry is that everything, it feels that you're not discovering stuff in the way that you used to. So I like those little idiosyncratic parts of the UK. But a program like Coast on TV does nothing but go around the UK trying to find those old acoustic mirrors and stuff that I felt were my secret 10 or 15 years ago. You know, the fact is that probably thousands of people, tens of thousands of people knew all about them. But part of my writing, a part of the excitement in my creating a piece of writing is that I feel like I'm lifting a rock and looking at bits and pieces that other people haven't seen. But that, you know, people have been writing novels for centuries, and you're always writing in the end about the same, you know, emotional stuff, I suppose. So you just perhaps have to dig a little deeper and look a little, you know, sideways at what you're doing, perhaps.
What set me thinking about this was the scene in The Underground Man where the Duke wants to find out about anatomy, and he goes off with his servants into Welbeck Abbey's library.
Oh, yeah.
Where they dig up bits of old books of anatomy. Yeah. And it struck me as there's a serendipity there that the information the Duke could get was only partial and only applied to him in that one moment. And it struck me that there was a metaphor for the writer and the, what you might call creative research.
Yeah.
That your idea of a patchwork, well, you've only created one kind of patchwork, but if all the patchwork is there.
Yeah. But that's perhaps why I like meeting and talking to a young Japanese woman about her life back in Japan or how she feels about being in the UK, because you're going to get detail. And again, it might well be off to the left or the right of what you're after, but you'll get stuff that you wouldn't get on the internet, in the same way that I buy books on Amazon like everybody else does, but you're not going to be in the bookshop and trip over that book about history that you'd have never thought about buying, but it's an interesting cover, or it's by that writer that a friend recommended another book by recently. So like you say, it's that serendipity. And you know, in a way, when you're developing an idea, you're constantly putting things in the way of yourself that you may trip over, and something interesting might happen. That's a terrible analogy for writing, but I think when you're researching, it is that sort of blundering, slightly mindless, and then, you know, profoundly intelligent approach to just churning ideas and, you know, endlessly write lists of books I should read, or galleries I should go to, or places I should visit, or experts I should talk to, la 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 la. And you know, a lot of that stuff goes out the window, but it's a sort of scaffolding, if you like, that you're using when you're constructing this thing. And at the end, you know, you take that scaffolding away, and yet the idea is that the reader believes that this tower, whatever it is you created, was always there.
You described it in our conversation as having elements of the conscious and the unconscious mind. Are you, in laying things out for yourself to trip over, is it a conversation that happens between those two parts of the mind?
Yeah. To be honest, I usually use that description for the actual writing, when you're actually writing a line of prose. And realistically, you know, that is that's a tiny minority of my or any writer's day, I think, the actual writing. Most of it you're thinking and staring out the window and you're not thinking of the other things that you shouldn't be thinking about. But I think when you're very often when I'm writing a line of dialogue or a piece of prose, there's that sort of balancing between I'm thinking, is this which bit of me is writing this now? And honestly, I don't care. I'm not interested. I don't want to fiddle around with something that might cause problems. But it seems to me that sometimes I'm writing stuff and being completely aware of what I'm doing, being quite contrived and manipulative, if you like. And at other times, I think, oh, where did that come from? There's something that's been plucked out of the back of your mind. For all I know, it's something I've stolen from some Dickens novel I read 25 years ago. But there's definitely something that's unconscious going on there. And I, despite all, you know, the creative writing courses and how much benefit I think they are, I think there's some part of the writing process that is kind of unknown or unknowable and is best just left alone, really.
Left alone in the unconscious dark.
Yeah.
Down in the tunnels.
Yeah.
It's striking also that you are currently writer-in-residence at the Booth Museum in Brighton. You have been writer-in-residence at the Science Museum.
Yeah.
Museums appear in your books. Are these a way of stumbling upon things, these collections of objects?
Yeah, you're full of good questions today, James, if you don't mind me saying. But no, that's it. I wouldn't have put those two things together, but I think that's what one of the things I do, well, that's the sort of quid pro quo. I might offer creative writing classes, I might bring people into the museum that wouldn't normally come, do talks and things like that. But the deal is that I get time to research stuff and I get to fumble about in the stores, and that's what I've done at the Booth Museum. And, you know, trust me, there's no end of weird stuff at the Booth Museum and at the Science Museum. It's just full of peculiar, arcane stuff. And
The arcane stuff that's moving and exciting you.
Well, to be honest, one of my favourite objects at the Booth Museum is a box. I mean, the Booth Museum's got, you know, tens of thousands of butterflies in cases, in drawers upstairs in the stores, and quite a few of them are out in the museum, but they've got a big butterfly collection. And there's a box upstairs on the mezzanine level, as they call it, where the curators work. And on the top it has a little sign saying, keep as an example of what not to do, or something like that. And it's essentially because the fumigation got wrong. You know, essentially these days you have drawers that are airtight and none of those little nasty critters can get in. And if you take the top of this cardboard box, it's just row upon row upon row of pins and labels and dust. Okay, so when I bring this out to show school groups when they come in, whatever I say, now this is natural history. This is what butterflies that are 150 years old should look like. The ones, you know, these luminous emerald butterflies that are pinned around the museum, that's not natural. Something terrible has happened to those creatures. Several, you know, horrible things have happened to them. But, you know, this box of dust and pins and labels are all in their little uniform rows. It's like some vision of the psalm or something like that, without wishing to be too tacky. But that tells you as much about history or about natural history or about museums as anything else does. You know, that as John Cooper, the head curator there, says, you know, the whole place is essentially food. That's dinner time for other smaller creatures. And what Booth and all the other collectors have managed to do is somehow keep those little buggers out. And I think that's a great concept. So that's a piece that I would always bring out of the stores at the Booth.
I'm irresistibly struck hearing about these survival with the novelistic process. In fact, your nameless widow character talks explicitly about what survives of a life, the objects that are left behind in a box, and how they don't have meaning for someone who comes across them. She dreads her precious mementos being found in a car boot sale lacking their meaning. I'm feeling some analogy with the novelist as a curator of dead things.
No, that's right. No, I think, well, you're right. And, well, that sense of revival or resurrection,
yes,
you know.
That's what I mean.
In a way, that's what museums are. They're keeping all these things alive and they're, you know, they're giving them space and they're honouring them in some respect. But I think the analogy works in that writers physically collect those things, or when they've got an idea, they go out and I certainly try and find those physical touchstones for an idea. And then in a way you're doing the same thing, you're honouring them, or you're yeah, you're presenting them to the reader and saying, what about these? What connections are we making here? Except, you know, with a writer, you've got a pretty nailed down path that you want the reader to take through your narrative. You could argue that with a museum, it's pretty straightened in some respects, but you can wander from room to room and do your own sweet thing. But no, there's certainly that idea of the collection or the stores, you know, behind the scenes. Everyone wants to go to the Boot Museum and see what's upstairs, all those boxes and drawers that are tucked away. And I'm absolutely with you.
It's exactly what I feel sitting here in your working space, looking at the books, the notes pinned to the wall, which charmingly are bleached by the sun.
So well, no, that's my own butterfly collection, I suppose, isn't it, really?
Yes, yeah, pinned, and almost illegible, so they're not quite dust, and they think they've morphed into something alive by now. Mick Jackson, it's been a huge pleasure and fascinating speaking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, James.
That was Mick Jackson in conversation with James McConaughey. You can find out more about Mick on his website at www.mickjackson.com. And that concludes episode 113, which was recorded by James McConaughey and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 114, RLF writers Robin Bolam, Alex Martin, Lynn Webster Wild and Peter Forbes share their enthusiasm for their favourite author. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.